Welcome to GovInnovator. I'm Andy Feldman. Henry Levin of Columbia University joins us today to talk about important analytical tools for policymakers, including cost-benefit analysis and cost-effectiveness analysis that can be used to judge different policy options. Here's a clip.
We work in the area of public investments, and we know that some public investments are very costly and may not have great benefits, and others may have very large benefits relative to cost. So that's at the center of benefit-cost analysis. We're going to ask the question, as far as we can tell, do the value of the benefits, in this case in dollars, exceed the costs of the investment?
What should results-focused policymakers know about cost-benefit analysis and cost-effectiveness analysis? We get an overview from Henry Levin, one of the nation's leading experts on these topics. He's a professor of economics and education at Columbia University and a professor emeritus at Stanford. He's the co-author of the book, Cost Effectiveness Analysis, Methods and Applications. He joins us by Skype from New York. Hank, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy.
Start us off with some history about how these techniques started to be used.
It's only really been in recent years that this has been catching on. You know, benefit cost analysis goes back to the 30s, the Great Depression, when the Congress was pressed by different regions of the country to invest in huge water resource projects like hydroelectric dams in order to get rural electrification, the deepening of harbors, and different parts of the country were competing mainly because they were concerned with employment to get huge investments for all of these. And the Congress didn't know what to do about it because they're all called water resource projects, but outcomes of potable water, electrification, deeper harbors, flood control, they're so different that how can you compare them? And that's when they first adopted benefit cost analysis, where the Corps of Army Engineers, who became responsible for these projects, was told, you come back to us and tell us only the projects where the benefits are at least equal to the costs. So it goes back a long way.
I want to start out by talking about cost-benefit analysis, or as you said, benefit-cost analysis. It's the same thing, whichever way you say it. Can you give us a brief summary of how you explain it to others?
Yes. We work in the area of public investments, and we know that some public investments are very costly and may not have great benefits, and others may have very large benefits relative to cost. So that's at the center of benefit-cost analysis. We're going to ask the question, as far as we can tell, do the value of the benefits, in this case in dollars, exceed the costs of the investment?
And Hank, can you give an example?
Yes. We work primarily in education. So we might ask the question, what does it cost to get additional high school graduates with a particular intervention, a particular educational program, and what are the benefits? And in this case, we'd probably do it for the taxpayer. We'd say, well, the taxpayer is paying for the intervention, and the question is, are there benefits to the taxpayer, and how large are they relative to the costs? We've done a lot of that kind of work. In this particular case, we have found not all dropout prevention programs have benefits exceeding their costs, but those that do are very, very valuable. Now, more specifically, I mentioned that the taxpayer pays the cost. And so what are the benefits to the taxpayer? Well, the first is that high school graduates have higher employment and earnings than high school dropouts. And that means that the tax revenues are generated that are higher than for high school dropouts. Secondly, high school graduates are less likely to get involved in the criminal justice system. They're less likely to be involved in public assistance programs. They are less likely to draw upon public health programs. And so for a whole range of public programs, we reduce the costs, and those are benefits to the taxpayer. And at the same time, we increase the tax revenues that they pay, also assisting the taxpayer. And we find that the benefits of a select number of these programs, not all of them, exceed the costs. And those are the ones that we ought to invest in.
One situation that to me helps illustrate the importance of thinking about costs and comparing different policy options is the case in which you might have two policies or interventions that both improve outcomes by a similar amount, but one might be a lot more expensive than the other. And if you only do program evaluation, in other words, if you only measure effectiveness, you might view both of those interventions as equally valuable. But when you add in a focus on costs, you get a different picture. Do you have an example, Hank, a real-life example that highlights that situation?
Yes. Early in my career, we were told that technology is going to replace a lot of traditional education and that we really have to invest in it, and particularly computer-assisted instruction. That is switching basically from a teacher-run classroom to one where the students do their work somewhat independently. Of course, there are adult monitors and teachers are around, but using computers. And what we did is we looked at some experiments, and the computer-assisted instruction did as well, and in some cases better, at least for particular functions. This was at the elementary level, so we were dealing with basic reading skills, basic math skills. But when we priced out in those days the cost of the technology, what we found is that the recommendation of those advocates would have increased the per student expenditure by about 25% just for essentially 10 minutes a day of work on computers. And we found that if we brought in classroom aides who did the same thing, that it would cost us about 4 to 5% of the budget. So this gives one example where you really want to look at costs, and to the degree that you can calculate benefits in dollar terms, that's really valuable too.
So a quick cost-benefit analysis 101 here. One step is to add up all the costs of, let's say, the intervention. What did it cost to run the program, for example? And what you end up with is a dollar amount of those costs. Next step, add up all the benefits that accrue. Let's say the benefits to taxpayers, if that's your lens, or it could be the benefits to participants in the program or to society at large. Whatever your perspective that you choose, you add up the relevant benefits in dollar terms. So you end up with a dollar amount of benefits. So Hank, we've got now two numbers in our hand. We've got the dollar amount of costs and the dollar amount of benefits. Tell us the next step. In other words, what are some of the indicators that you can create with that information?
Well, one of the most common is the benefit to cost ratio. That is, for every dollar of cost, how many dollars do you get of benefits? Now, if you get less than a dollar in benefits, it's not a worthwhile investment at all. That is, to pay a dollar and get 87 cents in benefits, that's not a good direction to go. So we're concerned, first of all, whether it meets the minimal criterion, that is, do benefits at least equal the cost? The second concern that we have is which of a set of alternatives that we face have the largest benefits relative to costs. The benefit to cost ratio is one measure. It's a very simple measure, but there are other measures that can be used also. A different metric is that of net benefits. Mm-hmm. Net benefits are simply what was the total cost of the investment? What were the total benefits? Benefits minus costs. And that's really important because you can have a very small investment with a high benefit to cost ratio, but it doesn't amount to very much in terms of benefits to, in this case, the taxpayer. That's our preoccupation, the taxpayer.
So a benefit cost ratio can be useful, and so can a net benefit calculation. For our listeners who are new to these subjects, I know it can take some time to digest, but hold on, we've got one more concept to introduce, which is cost-effectiveness analysis. It's actually simpler to calculate than cost-benefit analysis. Remember how I mentioned that in cost-benefit analysis, you add up all the benefits and actually get a dollar amount? In cost-effectiveness analysis, we skip that step. In other words, it doesn't monetize the benefits. Instead, it simply says for any two or more interventions, which will get me to some outcome that I'm looking for at a lower cost. For example, if you're the mayor and you want to achieve a 10% reduction in recidivism, you might ask, which of these two interventions will get me that 10% improvement for a lower cost? That's cost effectiveness analysis. Is that fair, Hank?
It's very well stated. Look, let's say we're talking about third grade reading scores. It would be very heroic to try to say this gain in reading scores is worth this much in some marketplace. And it would be inappropriate. But what we can do is to say, which of these programs or interventions gets the largest gain in reading score per dollar? Okay, so that would be good cost effectiveness.
A final question for you, which is that you've emphasized in your work that transparency in terms of methods is very important in this work. In other words, making sure that cost-benefit studies or cost-effectiveness studies are clear about the methods they use and the assumptions that they make. Tell us why that's particularly important for these topics.
Yes. These studies are such that people will often just give the bottom line and say, well, you know, the benefit to cost ratio is 12 to 1, and that means for every dollar of investment, you get a $12 return. Try to get that on Wall Street, and they try to impress you. But the real problem is that most people who use that kind of information don't know how the information was created. And in fact, unfortunately, people who produce some of these reports, I'm not talking about the well-known professional people who do this, but there are ways of just throwing something together, often with errors in it, and coming up with numbers. And since the audience doesn't know how this is put together or what is a legitimate way of doing this, all they hear is that bottom line. So what we try to do is to make everything as transparent as possible. So even people who oppose the particular conclusion that we come up with can tell us, not just, I don't agree with you, or no, it couldn't be that high, or oh no, it must be much higher. We hear that a lot. They have to tell us why they believe that it should be higher or lower. And what we can do is take their assumptions, and if they have some evidence that their assumptions are plausible, we can recalculate very easily because the method, the numbers that we use, et cetera, are all readily available and found in our reporting.
We'll end this portion of the interview here, but the conversation will continue. I'm going to ask Professor Levin to give us an example of how cost calculations have had an important recent impact on policy in New York City in particular, using the example of the CUNY ASAP program, and I'll post his answer to the blog. But for now, Henry Levin from Columbia University. Hank, thank you for being with us and for giving us a quick primer on these useful topics.
Sure. It's my pleasure, Andy.